This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thank you so much, all of you, for coming. Jikoji is a Buddhist temple, of course, and our practice traces back to the teachings of the historical Buddha, who lived in what is now India about 2,500 years ago. In Zen, we take this lineage very seriously. When someone becomes a teacher, like myself, one of the tasks is to write out the full line of teachers between us and Buddha. And so I did this. I have a paper at home that lists my name, and then the name of my teacher, and then the name of his teacher, and so on, all the way back to Buddha himself. And it's only about 100, 110 names. It's hard to know, of course, if it's totally accurate, but that's the record we have. And if you do the math, that's about 22, 25 years between teachers. And I realized as I was preparing this talk that it took me 22 years to become a teacher from when I was ordained, which I always thought was a bit slow, but it seems maybe it's just average. When Buddha first had his great awakening, he had no real interest in teaching. So the lineage almost started and ended just with him. He had no confidence in himself as a teacher. He felt what he had experienced in meditation was so special and so strange that he wouldn't be able to explain it to anyone else. There's even sort of a funny moment in the Buddhist scriptures where the gods descend and basically beg Buddha to start teaching. But he says that, you know, he just doesn't think anyone will understand, and that trying to teach and having no one understand would just be kind of depressing. And here he was in the bliss of awakening, having succeeded in his great quest, and trading that for the life of a failed teacher just seemed like a huge step down. And so he tells the gods he'd rather not. In the end, they convinced him, of course. They argued that even if only one student understood, that it would be worth it. And as it happened, Buddha was an excellent teacher, and many students understood. And Buddha's teachings launched this vast and sprawling lineage that has now spanned the globe across the millennia. In times, the lineage of teachers split and fragmented into all sorts of different schools. It's pretty clear that Buddha didn't want this to happen. When he laid out his rules for monks and nuns, causing a schism in the Sangha was listed among the most serious violations, up there with killing, sexual misconduct. He really wanted his Sangha, his community, to stick together. But we didn't, really. So now there are countless schools of Buddhism all over the world, all with somewhat different practices and beliefs. We have Theravada Buddhism in Southeast Asia, Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka. Mahayana Buddhism in East Asia, China, Korea, Vietnam, Japan. And the unique Vajrayana Buddhism in and around Tibet. And by now, just about all those schools are represented here in the West. Here at Jikoji, we practice Zen Buddhism. Zen is the Japanese pronunciation of a Chinese translation of a Sanskrit word, just meaning meditation. So when we talk about Zen Buddhism, we're talking about the school of Buddhism that prioritizes meditation above all else. That doesn't mean it's all we do. We read scriptures and perform rituals, as you've seen this morning. But meditation is our focus. Zen emerged in China as a sort of back to basics movement within Buddhism, trying to strip away a lot of the extra stuff and just get back to meditation where Buddha started. Even when we do other things, even when we eat lunch or take a walk, we try to do it in a meditative way. We consider meditation to be the core of Buddha's teachings. And yet at first, when Buddha started to teach, he hardly mentioned meditation at all. Buddha's first lecture mentions it briefly, I think perhaps twice, but just as part of a long list of all the things they want to work on. It wasn't the focus of that first talk at all. And I think if all you knew about Buddhism was that first talk, you wouldn't think that meditation was a very important part of it. So what did Buddha want to talk about when he first started teaching? If that talk wasn't really about meditation, what was it about? And the answer is that it was about balance. Up until that point, Buddha had lived a life of extremes. His parents had raised him in a palace as a prince, surrounded by every imaginable luxury, sheltering him from suffering of any kind. When he grew disillusioned with that life, he tried living a life of incredible hardship, fasting for days and weeks on end, holding his breath impossibly long, punishing himself over and over until he was near death, trying to see how much suffering he could take. And the truth is that neither approach worked. Running away from suffering didn't solve anything for Buddha. It always found you in the end. And chasing suffering didn't solve anything either. You couldn't overcome it through confrontation either. What Buddha found, and what he wanted to teach his first students, was that the key to overcoming suffering was what he called the middle way, the path that avoids extremes, neither hiding from suffering nor wallowing in suffering. Facing hardship when it comes without dwelling on it longer than we need to. This feels like a simple lesson. And in fact, Buddha's first lecture was very short. Shorter, I think, even than the talk I'm giving you now. Later, he gave much longer lectures, and he eventually went into all sorts of detail about meditation and various meditation techniques and all that. But the very first point he wanted to make was a simple one. Avoid the extremes. Find your middle path. If you stop and think about it, this first talk is a bit strange in another way too. It's not just that it's very short, but the narrative is a little confusing. As I said, the story of Buddha's great awakening is that he first tried living the pampered life of a prince, then he tried living the arduous life of an ascetic. After he had rejected both, he decided just to sit in meditation, as we've done this morning, until he had his great awakening. But what that means is that although he talks about the middle way as his great realization, as what came to him in his great awakening, he had already given up the extremes before that. He was already following the middle way before his awakening. So what exactly did he learn in that awakening after all? I think part of the answer, at least, is that there is a difference between knowing something and experiencing it. You've probably seen this in your own life. It's different to know about a place, even to see pictures of a place, and to actually visit it and experience it yourself. It's one thing to read about falling in love or see it in a movie, and another to fall in love yourself. I think the middle way is like that too. It's one thing to understand it theoretically, perhaps hear me talk about it, perhaps even feel convinced. Perhaps it sounds reasonable. But it's another to experience the middle way yourself, to feel for a moment what it's like to live completely in balance. And meditation can give us a taste of that experience. Sitting still, neither chasing thoughts nor pushing them away, experiencing each moment exactly as it comes. Our practice embodies the middle way. We don't just learn about it or think about it. We experience it directly. And in this way, we share an experience that people like us have shared since the Buddha's time. We connect with the countless teachers and students who have practiced this way and found their own middle path. I don't want to suggest that the middle way is easy. It's not. Living a life in balance is challenging. We make mistakes. We fall into one extreme or another. We chase things that we should ignore, and perhaps ignore things that we should chase. But Buddha never said it was easy. He just said it was possible. Because if he can do it, we can too. Thank you. We have some time for questions, either about what I was talking about or anything else that's come up for you in practicing this morning. And we can take questions online as well.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
I went to a presentation by a spiritual teacher. And his message is being present to oneself. And that's all there was to it. And he spoke for probably an hour and 45 minutes just saying the same thing, or simply being present to oneself, experiencing the transcendence of being, being caught up into the transcendence. It seems to me that's in the same tradition as Buddhism. Buddhism has a lot of description and guidelines and cautions. And I'm just aware that he has none. Just simply be present. I'm just wondering if you have, I'm balancing or not balancing. Seems like the tradition of Buddhism is much more developed, or I don't have quite language for that. But is that basically the same truth? Do you have any reflection on that?
I do think our teaching is to be present, and our practice in practicing meditation is to take some time to focus completely on being present, because it's difficult. It's easy to live life in a sort of half sleep where we're not being fully present, we're not paying attention to what we're doing. And sometimes just telling people to be present doesn't seem like enough. They need help. They need to develop that skill. And so meditation is an opportunity to practice that, literally. To go into a space like this with few distractions. You know, the lights are low. There's not a lot of sound. We sit facing the wall. So even with our eyes partially open, there's not a lot to see. And we just practice experiencing each moment exactly as it is. That's our only task when we sit. We're not trying to accomplish anything else. There's no particular tricks to it. We're just trying to experience every moment. And I think the hope is that by developing that, almost like a muscle memory of what it's like to be present, it's easier to carry that with us when we're not on the cushion. There's a certain skill to being present that we're developing when we sit in meditation. And I do think it's part of this middle path, part of this balance. For one thing, you can't ever find this balance if you're not paying attention. You're very unlikely to stumble on it just by accident. It requires, I think, constant sort of correction. We all have this tendency to fall into extremes. And so if we're not paying attention, if we're not present in each moment, even if we find that middle path, we'll lose it. We'll drift away. You know, we talk about meditating for 40 minutes or 30 minutes, or people sometimes will start off meditating 10 minutes at home. But you can't really meditate for 10 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes. You really can only meditate for one moment. And I do think the wonderful promise, if you will, of Zen Buddhism is that each moment is a completely fresh chance. Whatever you were doing in the last moment, whether you were present or not, in this moment, you get to start again. And so we try to be present for this moment, and then we try to be present for the next moment, and then we try to be present for the next moment. And that's our practice.
Thank you. That puts some things together for me. Thank you.
Of course. Other questions? Yes, please.
I've always wondered that that when Buddha achieved awakening, then in a sense, it seems to me just the story that he still retained like some sense of self, because, it's a question about how does awakening really work? Because like when he was awakened, in a way he was awakening. So he was that, he was, and it is expressed in various forms when it is said that together all beings achieved the supreme truth or the supreme enlightenment. And but the story says that after achieving awakening, he still had a doubt whether he can teach it to others or not. And so I'm just curious about this nature of awakening, that he kind of like still retained his self, the person who was enlightened, and he was enlightened. And we have seen that like later he wants to be called the Tathagata, but initially he still had that doubt.
It's of course difficult to talk about awakening and hard to know exactly what it means. You're right that at some level, being awakened, I mean, it literally became the Buddha's identity. He gave up his previous name and his name became Buddha, the awakened one. It just literally means that. But even so, it's not exactly clear what that means. So for example, to be awakened, is one always living in awakening. I often think of awakening as a sort of experience that I think many of us have at times, this experience of being fully awake in a way that is a little beyond what we experience in most of our everyday life. But for most of us, it's quite fleeting. We might have a moment that feels like that, maybe when we are completely present in some task. Maybe some people experience it falling in love. Some people experience it playing a sport where they're just fully, fully present in a way that seems different than usual. People describe colors seeming brighter, sounds clearer. So I imagine that's how Buddha felt, but did he always feel that way? I think there's some reason to believe he didn't. He gives a talk where he talks a little bit about when I dwell in awakening, and then talks about what he experiences. Well, that suggests that he wasn't always dwelling in awakening, that he could distinguish between when he was in that state and when he was not in that state. But I think even in this awakened state, it's not exactly that the self doesn't exist. It clearly does. You know, Buddha understood, I think, himself as a human person. You know, he got dressed in the morning like other people. He ate. He used normal pronouns like I and me to describe himself. So it wasn't that he felt he didn't exist. And plainly, he did exist. You know, as I sometimes say, if you threw a ball at him, it wouldn't go through him. It would bounce off. There's something there. I think when we talk about transcending the self, we don't mean that we're gone exactly. We mean that we understand that this self is not truly separate from all the other selves, and that it's not permanent and unchanging. That the illusion isn't exactly the self, it's this notion of a permanent, unchanging, separate self. And so, yes, I mean, Buddha was a teacher who taught. He did have a certain identity, an important identity, and a role to play that he accepted. But I think he understood, at least in these moments of dwelling and awakening, that this self that he embodied was not separate from all the other selves, that it was intimately connected with everything and all of us. At least that's how I am. Yes, please.
What is, in your understanding, the relation between Anivale and karma?
You know, the Buddha described karma as just this law of cause and effect, that actions have consequences. So, you know, in popular culture, we sometimes think about it as a morality issue. And I don't think that Buddha really thought about it that way. He thought about it as a fundamental property of the universe. I think a little bit like, you know, gravity. You know, if you drop something, it falls. And it doesn't fall because somebody decided it should fall, or because there's a rule that it's supposed to fall, or because, you know, Buddha said it should fall. It just falls because that's the way the universe is put together. The universe is put together in this mysterious way that causes masses to attract each other. I think he would have said the same thing about karma, that the universe is constructed in a certain way, that when we do certain actions, that has certain consequences. And for the most part, when we do good actions, there are good consequences. And when we do bad actions, there's bad consequences. And not because he said so, not because there's some judge evaluating each action and telling us whether it was good or bad and giving us some sort of sentence. It just happens the same way that apples fall from trees. To understand that, we have to be present. We have to pay attention. You know, because these are just kind of natural laws, you can't understand them just by reading about them. You know, with actual laws that are passed by people, you can just read the law and that tells you what's going to happen. And you can be pretty sure that that's what's going to happen because somebody's enforcing that law. But the law of karma is not enforced by anybody. It just is. And so the only way to understand it is to actually experience it and pay attention to it. Anything else would just be sort of an approximation. And so, you know, the middle way I do think of as this practice of paying attention, of being present, of noticing these things, and making these adjustments, understanding that when we veer one way or another, that we fall off this path, that when we find ourselves, you know, running away from suffering, that has bad consequences. When we find ourselves running towards suffering, that also can have bad consequences. And that's all that karma is about. Karma is about understanding actions and reactions, actions and consequences, paying attention to those and acting accordingly. That's how I understand it. Is there a question online?
Jackie?
Thanks. I have kind of a question as someone who has been informally following the Zen path for some years and wondering at what point or why one would go forward from this very simple and clear understanding that you are giving us about being present and meditating toward reading very in-depth texts and ancient writings and joining a community and you know, declaring your intention to the community that you are on the path and participating at Jikoji, which is probably, you know, where I would be because I come to Jikoji a lot. So I just find myself asking the question because people say, oh, it's really just simple. You just be present and as you were saying now. But then there's this wealth of, I'm trying to find the word for it, writings, Buddhist writings and scriptures, you might say. And how do they come into play?
Thank you. It is a bit of a paradox that the teachings are very simple, and yet there's, you know, countless books that have been written trying to explain them. And I don't know that there's a simple answer to your question. For me, understanding the history and tradition, I find helps me to understand, or at least to articulate the practice. But I don't know that it's necessary. Over the last few years, I've been studying Sanskrit and Pali, these ancient languages of the Buddhist scriptures. And people, when they hear that, often ask me if it's changed, you know, my practice and my understanding. And I don't know, not really, a little, maybe. I find it very interesting. You know, I got the chance to read the Heart Sutra that we just chanted in Sanskrit. And it more or less says what we think it says, as far as I can tell. I find it kind of interesting to see how these things were articulated so long ago. And similarly, I find it interesting to read the works of other teachers, you know, after Buddha, including modern teachers like Suzuki Roshi or our own teacher, Koban. But I don't know that it's necessary. I do think if you're content to just practice Zen, practice sitting, I wouldn't discourage you from doing that. And I certainly wouldn't encourage you to sort of substitute studying scriptures and such for meditation. I think some people find, and maybe I find this a bit, that it motivates them to study these things. And, you know, one thing I did when I was studying to be a teacher and towards the end of that practice is there are several accounts of the awakening experience of all the teachers since Buddha until I think roughly Dogen, who was the first teacher in Japan. And it was interesting to read that, you know, the ways each of them struggled and to understand that the struggles we have to overcome our narrow sense of self, to overcome suffering, are the same struggles that people have had for thousands of years. And in some ways, it's surprising. You might not think, you know, what would we have in common with these people who lived far away and in a very different time? You know, I often think about the fact that Buddha lived not just before, of course, any kind of screen or electronics, but, you know, before paper. And so you think about all the things that distract us today, that make us feel too distracted. And almost none of those things existed in Buddha's time. And yet he also felt too distracted. So what was distracting him? And I think the answer, of course, is that what was distracting him actually was the same thing that's distracting us. He was being distracted by his own mind. And that you don't need a cell phone to make your mind distract you. You can distract yourself just fine without one. And so reading of the Buddha's life and reflecting on that life, you know, it was somewhat helpful to me in sort of understanding that, understanding what the real distraction was in my own life. And so I think it can be helpful. In terms of the other part of your question, you know, why maybe sort of officially become a Buddhist, I think you used this phrase like declare yourself to the community. Again, I think it's very much a personal choice. Some people find that that helps motivate them. It helps them feel supported. In Buddhism, we talk about taking refuge in these three gems, in the Buddha, the teacher, the Dharma, the teachings, and the Sangha, the community of students. And that taking refuge, you know, I think it's meant literally that we find shelter, we find support in those three things. And so the first two you can really do on your own. You can take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma, find shelter in those things, sitting alone at home. But there is something quite special about finding refuge in the Sangha, finding support in a community of practitioners. You know, for myself, I mean, I've been sitting for I think I realized it was 35 years. But I still find it much easier, just literally easier, to sit in a temple with a group of people than alone at home in my own room. There is something about the support of the Sangha that seems to make a difference. But there is also a tradition in Buddhism, not so much in Zen, but even in Zen, of, you know, of hermits, of people who sit practice entirely on their own. And I knew one once who just really liked to practice on his own, had no particular need for practicing with others. And I think that's okay too. I think we all have to find our own balance. We all have to find our own middle path. Some people find so much support in a community that they move to a monastery. They live at Jokoji for a while, or, you know, there's people who have lived at Tassajara for decades. There are people who spend their whole life living in a practice community. And then there's other people who find no particular need for it and might visit now and then, but are really content to practice on their own. I think we all have a different middle path to find. And you should find yours. I think you certainly don't need to declare yourself a Buddhist or part of the community just because that's what other people do. But if you think it might be helpful, if it might offer some support to your practice, I think it can also be a powerful step. Well, thank you for the question.
Yep. Can I comment?
Sure.
I'm not qualified to answer Jackie's question, but like knowing Jackie for the last 5 or 6 years, I would say there's not one sangha, but two sanghas that will be happy if there is more of Jackie at Jokoji. Mm-hmm. One is the Jokoji Sangha, and then are the wonderful plants around Jokoji Sangha.
We have time for another question or two, if there's any more, either online or in the room.
I just really appreciate your talk about the premise, the main existential moment, and then explaining the existential moment. And I find this, like you basically said, I mean, I wonder if it has to do sort of with our long history of tool making to words and language explain, and it's entertaining and engaging, and it seems like you know, my body is meant to move and do things, you know, and I guess maybe some of it is now, maybe because of the meditation or just getting older, it's like the difficulty was identifying it so heavily. And you know, it's very invigorating for me to make things, whatever they are. And it is a product of my mind, but I guess it's a matter of making it my identity. And that's the greatest gift, as you said, of really of meditation, of stopping me. You know. So just thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I had a little continuation on what you were answering Annette's question about karma. And at one point you mentioned about good actions and versus bad actions, and that probably just plays out whichever one, which then there, I think the interesting conundrum there is about, well, is good and bad about intention or about the effects?
Mm.
Would you mind articulating the question?
So in the conversation we had earlier about karma, we talked about good actions having good consequences and bad actions having bad consequences, and that being something we can observe. And so the question was, is a good action an action with good intention, or an action with good results? I suppose one answer would be that you should try it and find out. That it doesn't really matter what I think the answer is. The universe is one way or the other. So you don't need me to tell you. You can just figure it out for yourself. That said, you know, my own sense is that intention is important. For one thing, you know, the law of karma wouldn't be very interesting if we were just saying that a good action is an action with good results, and good actions have good results. It's just true by definition. So it seems almost only worth articulating if there's something a little more to it than that. And I also think that you know, it's important not to hold ourselves to an impossible standard. Part of this practice of paying attention, looking for this middle path, is that we have to do some trial and error, which means there's going to be errors. I don't think it's really possible, as far as I can tell, to live a life that's always on that path. In some ways, the only way to know we're on it is by drifting a little and sort of finding the boundaries, finding the edges. In many respects, I think the path, it's not well marked. And so we have to do a little bit of exploring, which means we have to act. We have to pay attention to the consequences. We have to make changes, learn from our mistakes. And so, you know, for myself, when I notice I've made a mistake, which I do, of course, I do try not to be too hard on myself and to understand that mistakes are inevitable. But as long as we're paying attention, there can at least be some positive consequence of the mistake, which is that we can learn and we can get a better sense for the direction of the path. Of course, if we're not paying attention, then the mistake is just a mistake. It benefits no one. We learn nothing. And so I think that's another way in which intention matters. If we're acting with the intention of finding this middle way, and if we're paying attention to the consequences of our actions, then there'll always be at least some positive consequence of anything we do. If nothing else, but helping us understand where the path might be and how to get closer to it. Any other questions online before we wrap things up?
Andy?
Yeah, thank you for your talk. That was, it seemed to be very clarifying, and I'm thinking about a remark that was been on my mind for a while that I think Doug made in one of his talks a while back, and he was talking about, I don't know if I got this correct, but he was saying about how the notion of what was happening with Buddhism when it came to the West, made it academic or made it sort of a something that was studied and was called Buddhism. And he said that in other parts of the world, they just called it the way. And somehow the way versus Buddhism, the way seems very personal and very experience-oriented. Buddhism feels like something you study. You have to adjust to those studies. And I think when I first came into Buddhism, it was this whole body of literature and stuff that I had to try to figure out and adjust to. And as my practice has gone on, it's more become the way. And which, as you say, something that's very personal. And I remember this crazy quote by Gary Snyder, the beginning of one of his poems or something to the effect that the way is no way. So, it's kind of your talk really helped, I think, clarify a lot of that. So thank you.
Welcome. I think it is true that there isn't really a word for Buddhism, like in Sanskrit and Pali and in the Buddha's languages. You can talk about Buddha's teachings. You can talk about the middle path, middle way. But Buddha didn't think of himself as teaching something called Buddhism. He just thought of himself as teaching how the world worked. Again, I do think there's an analogy with like Isaac Newton and gravity. You know, he didn't set out to teach Newtonism. He was just trying to explain why things happened the way they did. And you could believe it or not, but he was pretty sure it was true. I think this tendency towards, academic study, it's not unique to the West. It certainly happens in Japan and China, Tibet. There are great Buddhist universities in all these places. And I think in some ways, Zen was a bit of a reaction to that, a desire to get things to be a little more simple and a little more focus on the practice itself. And so that's how we spend most of our time. We spend most of our time trying to actually practice these teachings and experiencing them for ourselves. And I really appreciate all of you coming and practicing these things with us together today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.